Accession number 23818, Reel 5.
Commander Easton, Reel 5. We were talking about when you got to Hingham and were about to join the Calder, or were joining it, and we were looking at some of the key figures on board. What about the engineering chief?
The chief of the engineering department, the only officer there, was a man considerably older than the rest of us, called Leach, known as Chiefy Leach. He would have been in his 40s. Highly respected, unflappable, excellent man altogether.
Was he familiar with electrical engines?
No, I think that he was given the necessary courses before he came out to America, and he and many others went off to the American technical factories and so on where courses were being run, especially for us chaps, on how to manage the American machinery.
Were you aware of his ERA, the electrical ERA, Ron Ayres? I know you know him later life, but were you aware of him then?
Yes, Ron Ayres was strongly connected with him, because he was known as the Gyro EA, Electrical Artificer, Gyro EA, and the senior of the Electrical Artificers, a senior chief petty officer. The gyro compass being of American manufacture, which none of us had ever seen before, and he did a course. He went off to do a course, and I think we later visited the Armour Gyro factory, which is a little story in itself. In that the weather had just turned very hot, and we were decided to go into tropical rig. Naval tropical rig, which is white shorts, white shirts, white stockings, white shoes, all very smart, but a bit dinky. And as we entered the main assembly hall of the Armour Gyro Corporation, which was vast, with a gasp went up from the rows and rows and rows of hundreds of girls assembling gyros, this remarkable sight of about four young Brits in their tropical rig. In those days, Americans didn't wear shorts, except what they called Bermuda shorts, which came down over the knees. That caused a short sensation, and we were whisked smartly through. But Ayres was a mainstay. Not only did he maintain the gyro compass to the best of his ability, because it was a very difficult machine, did a lot of radar maintenance and all the higher level electronic navigational aids, like the log, which measures your speed, and the various radio aids in navigation, were his concern. He was specially trained in all this, but he was an excellent man, tower of strength.
Any other Hatcher? Do you remember Warrant Officer Hatcher?
Yes, Hatcher was the so-called in those days torpedo gunner. He was the man who was in charge of explosives. The depth, the sort of submarine ordnance, like depth charges, and the weapon called the Hedgehog up on the forecastle of the ship. And also he had concern with the normal, more basic electrics. And of course, he was a watchkeeping officer.
Any other characters spring to mind? We'll perhaps come to them as we go along.
We mentioned John Huckle. He was the young RNVR midshipman.
Well, perhaps now we could talk a bit about the construction methods that you saw employed at Hingham, because they were unusual for the British eyes.
Well, to our eyes, they were revolutionary. The shipyard had been Virgin Meadow a year before, and it was entirely organised for this one task of producing destroyer escorts of the same design from start to finish. There were basically, of course, railway lines came into it from the big cities, Detroit and Pennsylvania and that kind of thing, through which every day freight trains came in with their loads of maybe ship's engines. I've seen a freight train carrying nothing but about 20 funnels come in. It's a remarkable sight, very well organised. Intersidings, which ran behind very large fabrication sheds. And the ship's hulls were manufactured in lengths of about, I guess, about 30 or 40 feet in these fabrication sheds. This is quite common these days, but in those days it was not. And all the metal joining was welding and no riveting. And the welding was done by women, almost entirely, if not entirely, gangs of women. From the sheds, in strict sequence, came the fabricated parts, which were joined up and welded together. And I think that each slipway, which led from the fabrication shed down to the water, was a fixed interval of time ahead of the one of its neighbour, and that didn't alter. I can't be sure of the interval. It was 1 or 2 weeks, very close anyhow, and nothing could disturb that sequence. It just had to happen that it was just like one more turn of the sausage machine wheel, as it were. Down came the ships, gradually becoming more and more looking like ships until they were launched at the end of the hull complete, taken straight along to a fitting out berth. So the fitting out berth was very long, it ran right along the bottoms of all the slipways, and at one end, let us say the first ship ever to be launched was right up the, let's say, the east end, and then they all came in sequence, and it rolled all the time as the first one left. Another one came and took its place, sort of like eggs in a fridge shelf. The stores were all kept in designated stores for each particular ship. As they are assembled, there they all were in one shed. But you've got to bear in mind that we only took one ship in seven, so it couldn't be completely anglicised. It must have been a headache to the Americans. There were some differences, you see. The ships had some differences in weaponry. And some differences that in stores, which although in general we fitted in with the American custom.
Could you perhaps talk a bit about the nature of the ships themselves? Because it wasn't just the construction that was unusual from the British perspective; it was also the nature of the actual ship. I mean, they had through decks; they were all welded. There are a variety of fittings and fixtures that were unusual. Could you talk about those aspects?
The ships came as quite a new experience to us. British ship design formed into a certain pattern. You could recognise a British design and built ship, say a destroyer or a frigate. In general, they were sort of sturdy and, of course, riveted. Now, the American ship, like these were to us a complete breakaway from that. You mentioned they were all welded with clear passages, giving an impression generally of more lightness. To me, it's rather like the difference between a sports car and a more traditional saloon, the American to English.
What did you think of the all welded? I mean, some people worried about it.
Well, I don't say we worried. We were impressed. Never had the least trouble with welding. It was very good. When we met our first storms, we did wonder whether it really was all strong enough, but it was.
What about the through decks?
Well, that was a great convenience for getting from one end of the ship to the other. I think for instance, the depth charge crews right on the back on the at the stern. I think they could get to their stations undercover the whole way from their mess decks if they were forward, which was a great help. But there would only be sort of one through deck in the hull, because the rest were all big compartments, engine rooms and boiler rooms and that kind of thing, and then dividing forward and aft into lots and lots of separate compartments.
What about the weaponry carried? What did you think of that as compared to what you were used to? Because the gun, the 3-inch gun was...
A mixed bag. The guns were pathetic. I think this was because even the American manufacturing capacity wasn't up to keeping pace with the requirements for modern guns. And these 3-inch were really, really basic. They fired a solid shell, for instance, one can scarcely believe. The projectile would not, in fact, pierce a submarine's pressure hull. It just bounced off.
So it wasn't an explosive. It didn't explode or detonate, you mean? Or are you not sure?
I'm not sure whether there were. So I think they were predominantly solid. I'm not sure. I wasn't concerned with the gunnery.
What about the other weaponry carriers?
Torpedoes and torpedo tubes, which the American ships had, we did not. We didn't foresee any use for torpedoes and torpedo tubes. We preferred to have the weight, extra weight carrying capacity devoted to extra depth charges.
Why was that? Yeah, if you could just explain.
Oh, I think that torpedoes are really for when you're possibly escorting one of the escorts of a fleet of larger vessels, and you're in for a naval battle. You attack other ships. We were built as anti-submarine vessels. We were little working in ones or twos, fighting the enemy beneath the surface, and there wasn't any use envisaged for torpedoes and the personnel as they would need to run them. Depth charges, we carried an enormous number of those. The outfit which the ship was provided with their necessary throwers, which threw them a distance from the ship, was continued right up the ship's side, each side, in a double row. So I think we had about 160 depth charges on deck all the time, which was tremendous. When you are in an anti-submarine action, you're firing 10 of these at a time, and you may want a new pattern possibly every 5 minutes. So we've got to carry a lot. The more sophisticated anti-submarine weapon was a British weapon called a Hedgehog.
Was that there when you got there, or was that fitted at the refit?
That was there when we got there, fitted on the forecastle, right up against the superstructure, the rear part of the forecastle. And 24 little spigots which were fitted the projectiles, which were trainable for direction, and so you fired at your target ahead of the ship. You didn't have to pass over the U-boat, then drop them on him, and they explode after you've gone. But you could approach slowly and aim this thing and fire. Away they go, drop in a big circular pattern about 100 yards or two ahead of you, go straight down, hopefully hit on the way down. We sunk one U-boat that way.
Oh, we'll come to that. What about the Bofors and Ehrlich and the pom-poms?
Yes. I believe the ship was fitted with a twin Bofors mounting at the building stage. But it had no close-range anti-aircraft capacity. And the very first thing that was put onto the ship, I believe it was... It was on one of our first ports of call. It might have been New York. They mounted four 20mm Oerlikon guns.
Now, what about the American fittings? Because, I mean, a thing that's often commented is they had bunk beds, they had a laundrette facility, they had water coolers, and perhaps other things that you can recall. These were, I believe, originally fitted on the Calder. How did people react to them, and what did you think of them?
Oh, very good. I think that most of the crew had never seen a washing machine in their lives before, and there was a laundry with these in. Generally, it was a new generation of accommodation fittings. Yes, we are very popular. The only thing slightly alarming was, as far as the ship's company heads or laboratories was concerned, was that they had no doors, so you just sat in a row, and that they were used to that. We weren't. So the first thing we had done when we got to Belfast was have doors put on those. Good galley. Yes, so they were a leap ahead of us. Yes.
Now, how did the ship come to life while you at Hingham?
Well, first of all, you would hear machinery trials going on, culminating in what we call basin trials, which is the ship still tied up, with the propellers being worked ahead and astern. You could see the wash from those, which was a sort of a real birth. There was very little time. We had, I think I recall, 2 days to saw ship in. Everything had to be done, though any difficulty just had to be swept aside or got around. And it was Jimmy Davidson's first lieutenant's job to liaise constantly with his American counterparts ashore, which gave rise to some no lasting difficulties, but look back on now, humorous scenes.
What sort of thing? Can you remember
anything? Oh, well, I recall a bit of a Barney about the stowage of rum, of kegs of rum, which we being one of the very first British ships to go through, they hadn't really got
you. Sorry,
really,
you mentioned that. Sorry, you
thought hadn't come to terms with yet.
What about as the crew came aboard? I mean, and the actual commissioning ceremony on the 15th of July. Do you recall that at all?
Yes, I do. Yes, the crew had all been gathering in Dry Dock Barracks, Boston, prior to commissioning. A certain number of sort of key men, mostly chief and petty officers like Ron Ayres, engine room people, had come down in advance, various degrees of advance. And the day came, we all came on board, gathered on the quarter deck, the after end of the ship. Americans would call the fantail, a quite adequate little ceremony conducted by an American chaplain. The American shipyard manager handed over the ship to the captain. Up went the white ensign. Just a half an hour of quite adequate ceremony, and it was all over.
And would the crew live on board from then on?
Yes, I think so. I think whether in fact there was any going back to barracks, there might have been for some, I really can't remember.
So the machinery and base and charts, anything else happened while you were at
Hingham?
How did the crew get on with the local Americans, both the sailors and the sort of civilians? Was there any trouble, or...?
No great trouble. I mean, it reached my ears there have been some scenes ashore from time to time, but it was all quite happily coped with, and I remember Jimmy Davison having to go into Boston or into Hingham, I think it probably was, to retrieve... three or four chaps who had been arrested that night, but nothing serious.
So they behaved themselves fairly well?
Oh, yes, yes.
Now, what's the next thing you remember then?
The first sea trial, cast off from the jetty, American pilot on board, through the narrow channels of Hingham Creek to some clear water, running up and down at different speeds, just general testing, and back alongside again, all very satisfactory.
From what you've just said, no particular problems?
Not that I can recall. That I think is most impressive. If there had been a big problem, it would have been most unfortunate. It would have delayed. The ship would have had to be put somewhere separate while they sorted it out. But I don't remember anything like that.
Anything else before you left for Bermuda?
Had to go to some little remote slipway for what is called degaussing.
Can you explain what that is?
Demagnification of the ship, demagnetising the ship. Demagnetizing the ship. Any steel ship, as she's built, gathers its magnetism according to its orientation in the Earth's magnetic field, and you've got to get rid of that because that can be a very dangerous attractant to mines or magnetic torpedoes. So there's counteracting coils. Electrical coils go round inside the ship. The whole thing has to be measured and calibrated. That's what that was. Just took one day on a slipway somewhere near Boston. I can't remember where it was.
Now, what about the voyage to Bermuda, your first long voyage? And there's two points of interest. One, the use of the gyroscopic compass, and the second, the hurricane you ran into.
Well, yes, this was our first voyage. A although it was midsummer, it was August, we had particularly bad weather, very bad indeed. And the seaworthiness of the ship was well and truly tested. And we soon learned she was a very lively ship. That is, a bit of a cork on the water. Very heavy rolling, very rapid, very quick rolling. There were no such thing as stabilizers in those days. And rather alarming crashing into the big seas with the mast and the rigging. They all stood the strain all right. But you mentioned the gyro compass. This was a great problem. The armour gyro obviously was not designed for this kind of treatment. It must have been designed for an altogether bigger ship, because it very, very quickly failed. It couldn't withstand the ship's motion pounding into waves and coming up, come up all standing into a big wave, almost like hitting a brick wall. The whole ship shudders. It couldn't take this. And several nights, the gyro EA and I were down together at the gyro compass. It's right in the bottom of the ship beneath the bridge, trying to nurse it like a patient in intensive care, pouring mercury back into the places where it had squirted out. But we just about kept it going, but it was very unreliable. A British ship would have had a proper standby magnetic compass on the bridge, properly fitted, properly adjusted, but these didn't have that. So we had quite a difficult time with our navigation at first.
Did the rolling make many people seasick? Was it?
Yes. I think a lot of people were seasick, of course. Most got over it quite quickly.
What about you?
I was terrible, I'm afraid. Only consoling myself that Nelson was reputed to be the same. But if you have a job to do, and when you're doing it, like most illnesses, you forget it. Difficulty is to get your meals down and get your water down. In this respect, Harold Fine was a great help to me. He was my yeoman, as I said before, and he would keep an eye on me and bring me up toast and butter and cups of box of soup from the galley from time to time to keep me on my feet.
Anything else about the journey, the voyage out?
It was with some relief we actually sighted Bermuda. It's a lot of ocean and a very small island. I think we saw a couple of ships who were exercising off Bermuda, which encouraged us, and they gave us a course to steer for the entrance channel.
Now, when you got there, this was to HMS Malabar, St. George's Harbour. Is it in St. George's Harbour?
No, the workout base where the old naval dockyard of Bermuda is, HMS Malabar, as you rightly say, is having entered the Bermuda by its channel through coral reefs at one end of the island. There's a tortuous and quite long channel right up through the coral reefs to the other end where Malabar was.
And that was your working up base?
That was there's a little dockyard there with a good little basin, a good stock of naval stores, surprising. A little team of officers and senior ratings to help us grapple with what we call working up, which is the getting to know the ship properly and the necessary procedures for using its weapons. And